Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Drew University Book Club Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Weaver, and with me, as always, my intrepid group of readers are here to plow through our latest and greatest book club selection, Entree Leadership by Dave Ramsey. We'll be covering Chapter 7 today, and to do that, I have the team assembled, so let's do a quick check-in on everybody. Suzanne Borgia, our HR director in Tampa. Hi, Suzanne. How's it going? Good morning indeed. Dustin Schatz, our delivery director in Tampa, also with us. Hi, Dustin.
How you doing, Jeff? Good morning.
Good. Glad to have you here. Chris Morgan, our Fort Myers C&G sales manager, is here. Hi, Chris.
Hey.
Dan Endres is back with us all the way from Minnesota. Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jeff. Good morning.
Good morning. And unfortunately, our inside sales manager, Lisa Velez, will not be joining us anymore, but I'm excited to announce that our director of e-commerce, Lisa Velez, will be joining us from this point forward. Congratulations and welcome, Lisa.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us as usual. So we are, of course, again, talking about Entree Leadership by Dave Ramsey, and we are up to Chapter 7, which is all about people. And that's something that we take a lot of pride in here at JJ Taylor. And Dave says with this chapter, business is easy until people get involved, which probably couldn't be more true. So I want to find out, what'd you guys think of Chapter 7? What'd you take away? What'd you learn? What'd you think was some of the big moments in Chapter 7 that you were struck by?
So I used to listen to Dave Ramsey when I was a sales rep, as like when I would be on the AM stations, and I was huge on Dave Ramsey. And one of the things that they used to always advertise is that working for Rambo Solutions is, you know, the best employer in the Tennessee area. It's been the running best employer for like 10 years or so. And looking at his whole hiring process, I can kind of understand why. That is like a, that's definitely not a quick jog. Like, that is a marathon, you know, and I could see why his employees are definitely engaged and why he's been the best employer in the area for however many years running it was that he's been.
Yeah, they make you earn it to get into the Lampo group, don't they?
Yes, Lampo, that's what it was. Yes.
Absolutely. What else? What struck you guys coming off this chapter?
Well, to Lisa's point, hiring is not a quick process. However, I often feel that we have to do it quickly. So the weight of our decision has to be, you know, he talks in here about time. The bigger decision, the longer you should take to make it. Unfortunately, we don't necessarily have that luxury of time, so we have to make big decisions in a quick amount of time. So our ability to read people and find somebody that's going to fit our team, he talks about that a lot too. They have to fit our team in order to succeed both ways, but it's hard to do in a short period of time. So our process, I wouldn't call it flawed. I would call it necessary. We just have to work within the grounds that we have.
No, absolutely. And I would totally agree. And I was also struck by that, you know, when we talked in the earlier chapters about making decisions and how the time of the decision, the time you put into making a decision has to be proportionate to the weight of the decision. You can see that seep into this chapter as well, as he really says, you know, these are the people you bring on board and the people of your organization are such a big decision. Are you giving it the right amount of time? And it is no doubt one of the biggest challenges of staffing, to balance that need to get someone new on board and fill the position and get the work done, with the fact that if we don't do it right, we're going to be doing it forever. And so that's definitely a part of this that I think we'll spend some time diving into. Any other big thoughts up top, opening statements, as it were?
I was just going to say, it echoes in so many of the BrewU trainings that we have, to hire slow and fire fast, you know, to really deal with those issues, but take your time hiring the right people.
Giving away all my tricks with giving you guys these books. Now you know where everything comes from.
And just for me, something that kind of struck me as, and I was a little conflicted when I read it, was it said, if you hire people who are broke, they do not make good team members. And I was conflicted with that, because I was like, well, they're looking for a job, so they probably need the money. But then he goes on to talk about, you know, if they have financial problems, that's all they're going to concentrate on, was getting to that next pay Friday. I just got to make it to get paid again. I got to pay this bill back, and or pay, you know, I got to pay for my car. It's going to get repoed. And then once that started to sink in, I was like, yeah, he's actually right. We can't hire that super desperate person who needs that job, because all their bills are piled up, because that's all they're going to think about 24 hours of the day. So that really stood out to me amongst all the, you know, the hiring things that they spoke about.
You know, that's an interesting point, Chris, and I want to dive into that a little bit. It's certainly aligned with all this. You know, they offer one of the things that they've offered and one of the things we've looked at, and we do have available options through the EAP and other things, is financial stability for employees and how important that can be. If you look at the research on it, it is fascinating how much that impacts performance, right? And it makes total sense empirically if you think about it. If somebody is, you know, dodging calls from their collectors, they're probably dodging every unknown number. Does that mean they're going to end up dodging our accounts as well because they don't have that number plugged in? If they're stressed out and completely worried about the, you know, that call they just got off of about the overdue bill, are they really putting their mind on their work? And I think about that a lot when I think about, especially like our delivery teams, is what's the mental state of the guys and gals that we put behind the wheel of our trucks? Are they in their best state of mind? And if they're stressed out, worked out, and completely distracted by other issues going on, are they concentrating on the road 100%? And that is part of why the, you know, his group offers, one of the things they offer is financial peace for businesses, where you can have employees taking that kind of stuff. We offer similar services. It's an interesting vector to consider from a staffing standpoint, but it is also, I think, an important vector as leaders and managers to consider with your teams. If people are having problems in their personal life, it seeps into the work. There's just no way around it. And you're exactly right. It's you know, what's going to motivate them? What's going to keep them going? We want our teams to be hungry and passionate and get things done, but we want them to be the right kind of hungry. And so obviously for an organization like theirs, where culture and reputation is built on financial stability, I can see how they make it a hiring vector. We probably would never reach the point where it's a hiring decision for us, but it's definitely something I think as leaders, we should be attuned to our teams and make sure they're healthy in all ways. Because if they're not, it's definitely going to take a toll on the work and cause them to make bad decisions or fall behind. Or, you know, again, it's how dedicated and passionate can somebody be in one area of life if the other areas aren't going well? It's why total wellness and EAP and things like that are such a big part of what we should be looking at as leaders. It's a bit of a tangent, but I like that tangent. So thank you for going there. So one of the things that struck me about this chapter is that even though it's about hiring and firing, he starts with a pretty big lecture, we'll call it, on the cost of turnover. And I think that's such a great place to start in this, is to really understand the cost of what turnover does. It's such an underrated impact on how it, you know, affects our business. And I really love that he differentiates between good turnover and bad turnover. What did you guys think about the turnover discussion being right at the top of this chapter and the differences between good turnover versus bad turnover?
I thought it was definitely a good thing to bring up right from the start, because it's extremely expensive, or there's a whole lot of cost with high turnover. And it just echoes the importance of taking your time, hiring the right person, you know, training the whole nine yards, because you're trying to avoid, the ultimate goal is to avoid that turnover and how costly it is. So I thought it was a good piece to start off.
I also agree with it, just putting it back on the hiring manager, which is so true. One of the highlights that I made, team members leave or are let go most often because they should have never been hired in the first place. So not only are we having to fire someone, maybe due to performance or inability to do the job, but people leaving too. You know, it's thinking about, you chose someone who was overqualified for the position and then they found something new. And so often I think it's important to think about those things when you're hiring.
Yeah, his team really takes total fit into consideration, right? It's more than just, can they do the job? It's more than just, do they have the references or the resume? They're really looking at that cultural alignment. And going back to the top, you know, again, when we first talked about the importance of instilling passion in your teams, the importance of surrounding yourself with team members, you've got to get that right at the selection. It's, you know, Dave talks about real estate a lot in his radio show, and he says you make your money on the buy in real estate. It's never when you sell it. It's how good a deal you got up front. I feel like when it comes to people and staffing, it's the same thing. You make your money in staffing on the buy. When you make the decision to bring somebody on board, that's what's going to determine how good a return on investment you get. If you make the right buy, they're going to be there a long time. They're going to be trainable. They're going to be passionate. They're going to be committed. You get the wrong person up front, you're going to be behind from the get-go. And it's tough. It's tough because there is, again, that urgency of we're down, you know, and we've got a workload to deal with. But at the same time, the importance of that position to us has to be proportionate to the time we put into it to doing it. Other thoughts on, I really did like the good turnover versus bad turnover. What did you guys think about? Because he talks about how there's, you know, the total turnover for their company is around, he says, 9%. But they only say their turnover is around 4%. Because there's 5% of turnover that they basically consider good turnover, turnover that they want to happen, either poor performance or perhaps improved, you know, team members who are able to, you know, go on to bigger and better things or do other stuff. And only about a handful of that turnover is turnover that they're not looking for. I think there's a lot of truth in that. I think companies should never look at turnover as exclusively bad. There are unavoidable turnovers and there are turnovers that are good for everyone. So what are your thoughts and feelings around good versus bad turnover?
I agree with that as well. As you know, sometimes, you know, we turn over people who are moving on to something maybe better for them. Maybe, you know, maybe the hours that we work or the days just didn't fit them anymore and they're going to move on to something else. Maybe they're moving on into law enforcement or going into the military full time or teaching, or they just, you know, just because they're not with us doesn't mean they're against us. You know, they can move on to other things. And, you know, I applaud that they talked about and they spoke about. You know, there is good turnover. There is times that people need to move on. So
I've been pretty fortunate to promote a bunch of people, not a bunch, but a handful of people from my department. And I will say that it's kind of hard to let them go because they do such a great job, you know, but it's at the same time, sitting in those interviews, I'm always looking to see who's my next person that I could try. And I've learned to kind of not try to be territorial over my people, you know, and just trying to picture them in different roles in the company, you know? So it's like, it's nice to have some good turnover in there. It really is nice to have some good turnover in there. It doesn't make it any easier though, to find the next person to sit down and do the job that we have at hand though.
There's a phrase we use in my world called being an exporter of talent. The idea being that if you're really good at training and developing and growing people, eventually you'll have more people ready for the next step than you'll have next steps available. And you end up becoming a place where people start their career and move on to other things. And that's not a bad place to be. You can be an exporter of talent and a grower of talent. And the good news is oftentimes those talent people are able to go out, get some more experience somewhere else, and they'll come back to you one day. And so it's if your team is an exporter of talent, it can feel rough, right? Lisa, you said it exactly right. It can feel rough to lose those top performers. But at the same time, most of us got where we are because we were a great performer that someone was willing to let go and move forward. So we do have to keep that in mind that it's not bad turnover if our teams are moving up and doing better and doing more. And that just gives us an opportunity to, again, bring in new talent and build even more bench strength over time. Very cool. So most turnover should never have been hired is, I think, key. And Suzanne, you touched on this, and I couldn't agree more that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure in this case. But of course, try explaining that to managers that are in the trenches and down three or four guys. It's a really tough thing. So how do we try to get more time into the process, or how do we try to put more safeguards into the process? Which I think, you know, they talk a lot about, they have this 12-step process for hiring. And that probably works well when you have a white-collar workforce and a lot of people who do a lot of the same jobs. But when you're dealing with hourly positions and higher, you know, naturally higher turnover positions, that can be cumbersome to the point of burdensome. I can't imagine us having a 12-step process where we're taking people out to dinner and interviewing their spouse along the way. It would be a bit overkill. So I think the real thing that I took out of that was they've put a lot of safety checks into their process, multiple interviews, multiple touch points. And it's not so much about the total time that it takes, but it's about making sure that they've checked all the right boxes before they move over. And so my thought, my question for you guys is, if we don't have time, what can we maybe do as leaders and managers to put some more of those safety checks into place that don't necessarily slow us down? They'll probably slow us down a little, but don't slow us down too much while also, again, it's that slow down to speed up mentality we always talk about. If there's a couple extra things we can do that will gain us a lot on the back end and reduce that turnover better, any thoughts or experiences or things you guys have seen or done that you think might work in that direction?
Yeah, I'll chime in here. Up here in Minnesota, we have recently had quite a bit of turnover. And I look at this as an opportunity for my managers and for me to further build out our team. That being said, one tool that we've used very well recently is referrals. He talks about that as step two of this 12-step process. I hired a manager from Top Golf, and she has already brought on two other people onto our team from Top Golf, and they have been phenomenal hires. In fact, my most recent sales rep, if you look at step seven, do they light up? She absolutely lit up. I got more excited about doing my job because how excited she is to do her job. So we've kind of used a combination of these. Although we don't have a lot of time, we've used referrals and hired the right people, and I'm very excited about the opportunity.
Oh, that's great. And I couldn't agree with you more, Dan. I think the referral factor is so underrated when it comes to getting the right people in, because again, it's all about culture. We want to build the culture and build the team. The people we want here are surrounding themselves in their own lives with people just like them. And that's what we want to bring in. So having a really strong referral culture, I think, is such an important part of building the team we want to build and maintaining the culture. It's all about culture. And that can be a huge way into that.
I know for me on my team, recently, I'd say last year, I had to hire a few sales reps. And the first rep that I hired came from within, from one of our other managers. He was a merchandiser, and he was excellent. So for me, I went back to that same manager when I needed a next position. I said, hey, bring me another guy. Who do you got? And now I've got half of my team came from the same group, the same management team, because I already saw it. It's similar to the referral, but I already saw how they worked, and they all turned out, they panned out excellent. So I love hiring from within because I already know they're engulfed in our culture. They already, you know, they're already in it to win it, so to say. So.
Yep. We love homegrown talent, and homegrown talent has that advantage of already being steeped in the culture we want them in. And I think anytime we can look homegrown, we should, you know, and those types of positions, especially what you're outlining there, Chris, you're exactly right. It's a small step from merchandiser up to sales rep, but it's a huge advantage if we're able to get that talent from within the company. It's a thing that I'd love to see us continue to keep growing and doing more of. And especially I think in some other areas that are often overlooked, you know, draft and other places where we forget that we have some of these departments, and yet if we've got the talent and can move people laterally, you know, that's another way to, again, keep our talent pool growing and building our team's talent stacks while getting the culture that we want.
I know that in delivery we've been focusing a lot on the interviewees, the guy or managers, as far as just developing them to be able to spot the key traits and what to look for in interviews, to develop them, the better they are at interviewing potential employees and selling the company to them, the more training that they get, we actually go through the selection process a little bit better and end up recruiting better talent.
And Dustin, all your guys do their own interviews, right? I mean, all of your managers are involved in the interviews for the teams that they lead?
Correct. Yeah, they all, them and the manager and the team lead does all the hiring for their specific team. So I put them in charge so that way they have the ownership of building their own team, for them to be proud of their team and take full responsibility of it.
That is such a great thing to do. And I think that's so important that managers are involved in their own hiring. It's, again, going back to the beginning when Dave talks about it's your team, right? You own them. They're yours. You hired them. You can fire them. And if they're a problem, they're your problem. Well, that for that to be true, they have to have been involved in that hiring and selection process. And so I love that you do that, Dustin. I love that your teams are that involved, because you're exactly right. It's their folks. It's their people. If they're not involved from the selection, then they've got that always out to say, well, I didn't want this person. I got stuck with this person. But when we involve our leaders and our managers in their own hiring process, it's that sense of ownership and responsibility that I think makes them try a little harder when it comes to the training and the onboarding and getting them there. Cause it's like, I've made this choice. Now I've got to invest in it cause I want it to succeed. Cause it's my name on the line. But also lets them feel more involved with, you know, who they're getting, so that they can be more selective and be more picky. And that's a key aspect of here. Again, what he's talking about is it's on you. So, big props to you and your team that has managed to get not just the delivery managers, but even getting the team leaders involved, I think is a really great example of how to make sure that teams are owning their own talent stack, which is great. I really liked when he talked about the job postings and how they inject a little bit of their culture into the job postings. Did anybody else have thoughts on that piece?
I did like how you put something funny in the job postings just to show that, again, that culture of, that's how we are. That's how we're gonna work hard, but we're gonna have a great time doing it. And I thought that was great. I don't think I've ever seen a job posting that had like a funny line in it or something funny like that.
It was a really interesting idea, Chris. I agree, because I think exactly it shows off the culture, right? And ultimately, it's a marketing tool, right? When we post a job, we're in a sense, we're trying to attract or advertise for a position. Advertising should reflect the product. And if our culture is fun, our advertising should be fun. If our culture is hardworking, our advertising should do that. And so I thought that was a really interesting bit to consider, that as a manager, as you're putting out that job description, as you're putting out that posting, what are we doing to make sure that it reflects it? And also carrying through to the interview and the discussions. You know, part of what we do in the interview room is we're selling someone on why they should come be a part of our team. As much as they're selling us on them as a candidate, we need to be selling them on this is who we are. This is our culture. This is the way we operate. If our personality as a company isn't coming through, we're missing an opportunity to make sure they're the right fit. If the interview's all business and then they come in and find out we're a bunch of jokesters, we might misread that room or vice versa. So I thought that was a fun piece. So let's get into the hiring and selection part a little further, because he gives these 12 steps, and we probably won't go through all 12 of them. But he does talk about his 12-step process and some of the things that they do. Did anything stick out to you guys about that 12-step process and things that they're doing that maybe we're not, or things that they're doing that you thought were admirable, or things that they're doing that you were like, well, that was totally overkill?
I personally liked the whole first step, that, you know, prayer is a huge part. So if I know I'm hiring for a position, then I'm going to pray about it first. Whether you're faithful or not faithful, it doesn't matter. However, you should always listen to your gut instinct, you know? And I know that I've dodged a couple of bullets by listening to my gut instinct, you know? I think another important point that he put on there was, do you like them? You know, I mean, because it's like, you could be interviewing someone that's got all the perfect answers on those behaviorals, and that's great. But I don't so much listen to just what they're answering on the behaviorals. I ask like a lot of probing questions afterwards just to try to figure out their personality type and see if I can work with this person, if this person's going to fit in with my team. You know, those were like huge things to me. And a lot of it is personality based, but a lot of it is also what's being said, but more so what's not being said, you know. And, you know, I really do think trusting your gut instinct on that is a big deal.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Lisa. I think taking the time to be reflective before making any big decision is super important. And I love that he asks that question so point blank. Just, do you like this person? There are a lot of qualified people, right? There are a lot of people that have a CDL license. There are a lot of people who have sales experience. We're going to find a lot of qualified people. So what differentiates qualified from right for us? And one of those questions is, do I like working with this person? Do they like working with me? Are we going to be happy to see each other? Because we're going to see each other every day. And your team operates in a single room in a warehouse. So I can totally see where if you've got clashing personalities, that is a disqualifying event, because they're going to have to live in that every day. And are you willing to sacrifice the happiness of your whole team just to do that? Lisa, when you interview, do you have other team members sit in on those interviews at all?
No, I have not had any of my people sit in. I will tell you though, that whenever they know that there's an interviewee coming in, they all manage to walk by the front desk so that they can scope them out, you know, and I get the opinion from them, you know. There have been a couple times where I've had to make a decision between one or two people, and I brought them in to work half a day to see how the people have fit in with my group. And then, you know, and of course I take their opinions into consideration. It's important to me, you know. But no, I don't have them actually sit in on that, because then I'd have to figure out who I'm going to pick, and they'd all want to come in and nobody would get anything done. So
I actually like the way you do it, of having them come in and work the half day and seeing what it looks like in the real world. And I think especially, like I said, with your team, it's such a small, close-knit team that operates in a single location. Having read this chapter, I would sit there and go, gosh, I can't now imagine not getting them to weigh in on it. I'd almost always want to at least have a meet and greet opportunity. And that's another one of those things that, do we take the time to think about how are people going to gel? But if they're going to be working closely with a lot of people, you want to make sure they're not just a good fit with the interviewer, but with the people they might work around. So, you know, taking the time to walk them around, introduce them before you make that final selection, and get that vibe from everybody else that they are going to have direct interface with could be a really key part. Again, all about keeping that culture. Other thoughts on his interview steps process or things that they brought up?
I really liked his point when he said you have two ears and one mouth. So listen twice as much and talk, you know, less. And also that idea translates into using our interview packets that we're given by HR, which are great, but they're just a jumping off point. I really like going off script because you can really find a lot out about a person in a short period of time by asking probing questions and kind of off the cuff questions and seeing how they handle it. A lot of good interviewees are prepared to answer the canned questions we give them. They're not necessarily prepared to answer something off the cuff. So putting them in the hot seat a little bit and listening twice as much, I think, has been a good tool for me.
Yeah, Dan, I couldn't agree with you more on that. It's the interview packets are great and they are a great starting point, but they're just that. They're a starting point. And the stuff that we learn is what, you know, listen, that's, I think, a big part of it, right? Too many bad hiring interviewers that I've watched, one of the mistakes they make is they're just listening for that, you know, I'm asking this question, there's a certain type of response, and once I get it, I stop listening for anything else. But the truth is, ask the question, then get out of the way, stop talking, let them go, see what you find out, and then see how far down that rabbit hole you can take it. So I think that's a perfect explanation of the right way to approach those kinds of guided questions.
I think similar to what Dan said in the interview, one of the things they talked about was putting too much info into your ads so that people could rule themselves out. So similar to what Dan said, I like to, in my interviews, not only go off the questions that we know are kind of generic questions, but I like to tell them exactly what this job entails. And I don't mean just you have to be able to lift this amount of weight. I tell them, you know, here's an MBO. This is what, these are the, what you have to hit to get paid. These are the distribution points. This is what distribution points looks like. You're going to have to deal with this many accounts a day. You're expected to start your day this time. Like, I tell them exactly everything because I don't want them to show up day one and they're like, oh man, I have to start at 6 o'clock in the morning, or man, some days I'm working till 4:30, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So I didn't want that to be a surprise or a shock or a wow, this MBO, how come there's so much stuff on here? Or, you know, so I like to just overly tell them everything. That way, if it's not going to work out for them, then they can automatically rule themselves out. I've actually been in an interview where I told a guy, you know, this is what we do. Then we have to merchandise these stores and we have to do this. And the guy literally said to me, oh, I didn't know I had to merchandise any stores too. I thought I just called the people on the phone or whatever. I said, no, no, this is probably not going to work out for you. And we ended it right there. So, I mean, I love to just overly tell them, like, you know, so that way there's no shock coming into this.
Yeah. When he talks about key results areas and a thorough job description, it couldn't be more apt. People need to understand what they're signing up for in terms of the daily work, the physicality of the work, and the expectations. What am I going to be held accountable for? What's expected of me? And you almost, you're right, Chris, you can't oversell that. You can't overstate it. I always say err on the side of making them feel a little overwhelmed. Because if they get overwhelmed and they feel like they can't handle it just by hearing about it, there's no way they're going to be able to do it. And if they hear all of that and they get that little tinge of, that sounds like a challenge and I'm up for a challenge, that's the kind of culture that we are. And that's the kind of people that are, you'll see it. You'll see them light up a little bit at, ooh, that sounds like a lot, but in a good way, versus, ooh, that sounds like I'm going to have to be doing a lot of work and I don't want it.
Yeah, there are several positions, to Lisa's point, that we do working interviews for. And they're positions that we find it really important to, because either it's a close-knit, you know, settlement, telcel always, you know, those close-knit groups, that it's really important that they understand how, you know, the position can be, the culture, not just getting along with the people who are working with you, but all of their internal customers, delivery, sales, you know, some of those positions people think, oh, it'll be so easy, I'm just taking money in settlement. No, you've got to deal with drivers every day. You've got to deal with the accounting piece. You've got to sit in a room with, you know, two or three people. So I think the working interview is really important. And to your point of really selling the truth of the position, the good, the bad, the ugly, is really important.
Absolutely couldn't agree more. I think that's, it's so important to give people a realistic preview of what they're getting into and make sure they're on board for it. Because it's all about passion, you know, and he talks about that. We talk about how important passion is, and that's the question, is are we hiring for it? And here's my question. When it comes to the passion that we're looking for, what kind of passion are we looking for? What kind of passion do our people need to have? I think that's a question that as managers and leaders, when we go into an interview setting, do we know? And can we answer that question? Because otherwise, how do we know what we're looking for? We get a lot of people who want to get involved with us because they have a passion for beer. And we're a beer company, so it's not unsuspecting that people might come here with a passion for beer. But at the end of the day, I'll ask this group of smart people, is a passion for beer what's going to determine who's successful at J.J. Taylor? Don't shake your head on a podcast. You have to actually speak out loud. They're all shaking their head at me on video, you guys. You don't even see it, but they're all like, no, it's audio format. No, so what passion are we looking for? What passion does our team have to have in order to be successful here?
Passion for people.
Absolutely. I think it's a passion for people. I think it's a passion for serving. I think it's a passion for customer service. I think it's a passion for helping people achieve their most, right? If you think about what our sales reps really do, they're out there trying to get the right products in the right account to make these businesses grow. If you think about what our delivery drivers are doing, it's not just make the beer show up. It's make the account look good and get things where they belong and make sure the best beer is on the floor at the right time. Our people have to have a passion for customer service. If they don't have that passion, if they don't love delighting others, then they don't have the passion we need. A passion for beer is fun. But at the end of the day, what we really do for people, we don't make beer, we sell beer. And selling beer is about serving our customers and our accounts the best way possible. And so if they don't have a passion for customer service, I think they don't have the passion we need to be successful. And so that's definitely something to consider as you're looking at your team and you're looking at your hiring decisions. If they've got a passion for the product, that's good. But if they have a passion for customer service and for helping others, that's essential. And so you got to know what kind of passion you're selecting for if you're going to be able to select for passion. So again, I think Ramsey's process might be a little bit much for most of us. 12 steps and a couple of months timeline is probably not the right flavor. But is there anything else or anything that you came away with off of these chapters going, gosh, we should maybe consider, or I might consider doing this now in my hiring process as part of my own team selection? Anything that you guys sort of had aha moments over?
I liked the whole DISC assessment, like trying to figure out, I really want to spend a little time trying to figure out if a person is more dominant, if they're more steady or influencer, you know, and just trying to, I mean, it's kind of hard to do that in a 45 minute time frame, but it's not something I've never even considered looking for, you know, just to see how a person would fit with their selling styles and with their customer service, you know, just like, I mean, everything kind of all fits together and it's just another tool to use, you know?
And of course we don't do DISC here. We've dabbled in it before. But we do have, for those of you that True Colors is our version of DISC. And while it's not a selection tool, you can't make a decision on whether someone's fit for a position with True Colors. You can definitely know where your team is at and if they would fit in your team or how they might fit in your team if you do that. And in fact, there's some new tools coming on that where we can now have people do True Colors assessment online. In the past, that's always been a live assessment where a qualified assessor has to kind of walk them through the process. But there's now even an online tool for that. And it's something to keep in mind that we have, you know, between the Harrison assessment or True Colors assessment or things like that. Once you've made the decision, it's good to know how someone might fit in your team and mesh with your people. So I think those tools can be a big part of onboarding, if not, again, they're not necessarily selection tools, but they're definitely a vector to keep in mind and certainly can be a big part of the onboarding to understand who the people are that you're selecting. So yeah, I noticed that he used DISC, and DISC's a good tool. It's, you know, there's a lot of good tools out there, but we do have True Colors as sort of that same flavor for us. It actually measures the same stuff. Anything else?
I do like the, I guess it wasn't much, it was more of listening to you guys, but I do like the bringing the person back, letting them spend a half a day working. Yeah, I do like that. We've done it with internals and let them, you know, like if a driver wanted to come into sales, let him work with one of my guys for a day or vice versa. But I've never thought about doing that with an external person because that would immediately, again, weed them out if this is not going to be for them. You know, if they can't get up in the morning or if they, you know, don't want to go in and out of a cooler all day, then this is probably not the job for them. So,
you know, Chris, one of the things I've always wondered about with sales and do you cover, you've got small format, right? So you have like Wawa's and stuff on your route?
Yes. Yeah.
Why not do an interview at 6 a.m. at a Wawa and have them work the cooler with you and then sit at the cafe table with a cup of coffee and finish the rest of the interview that way? Because if they can't take an interview at 6 a.m., how in the heck are they going to get up at 6 a.m. and run route every day, right? Like I it's one of those weird things, but it's like, you know, why do we run interviews from 9 to 5 if the job isn't 9 to 5? Why do we run interviews in an office environment if the job takes place in the field? And maybe one thing to consider is, can I do that? Can I take an interview, say, meet me at this Wawa at 6 a.m. We're going to go together. We're going to work this cooler. And then I'm going to, you know, have you talk to me, or you're going to watch me work this cooler so you can see how physical and intense the job is. And while I'm doing it, I'm going to ask you questions. And I know we've got to, you know, consider safety, consider liability, things like that. But I do like the idea of pushing some, you know, boundaries outside of just the traditional office interview, because, you know, people can prepare for that. But are they really prepared to meet me at 6 a.m., have a cup of coffee, sit across a table? And we have accounts that can make that possible. So it is an interesting idea to consider. I like that. Very, very fun. All right, so if that's the addition part of the team, then the other half of the equation is subtraction. And in this chapter, he also talks about the decision to remove people from the team, the firing aspect of being a leader. So talk to me a little bit about what you guys took away from that portion of this chapter.
I like how he went into detail about talking about underperforming employee. You know, why is he underperforming? Is he just a bad employee? Does he not care? Are we failing him somehow? Is it a training issue? You know, similar to how we do accident investigations here, it's kind of like a root cause investigation of why he's underperforming. And that's something that I try to work with the managers on. You know, the first thing that they do is they come to me and say, hey, I got a complaint about this guy. Well, why did he have a complaint? Did he have a 16-hour work day? Is he always been this way? Is this something new? Is there something going on in his, you know, personal life? Is there something we can help with? You know, try to look to get to the root cause of why this person's underperforming. And sometimes it's just that employee, but a lot of times there's underlying issues once we dig into it a little bit.
Oh, I love that phrase, the root cause of the performance problem. What a great way to approach that mindset. Because you're exactly right, Dustin, especially when we have a long-term good performing employee that all of a sudden seems to be declining. You got to stop and ask yourself, we know this person is capable. What's changed? And getting to that. And, you know, I when we teach performance management, I've always believed in this same kind of checklist that says you first have to hold yourself as the leader accountable. Were they properly trained? Did they have all the tools and resources needed? Did they have clear expectations and priorities? And if the answer to any of those is no, it's on us. We failed them. And if the answer is yes, then we have to look at them and say, all right, now what do we do to hold this person accountable? But getting to the root cause of it is something that a lot of people overlook. And unfortunately for our employees, we do them a disservice when we fail to take the time to understand why performance isn't meeting expectations, especially if the reason turns out to be we didn't do something right.
I like how you said, regardless of the reason for the, and he uses the word release, also known as the firing, to treat people right and with kindness, because you are in control and you still have a job and they have neither. And I think that does ring true, because, you know, at the end of the day, no matter how bad the performance was, having to let someone go is never a good feeling. You know, even some of the worst employees, you still feel bad. You still know they're married, they have children, they've got a mortgage, or they pay rent. So, you know, now they're not here and they don't have a job, what's going to happen to them kind of goes through your mind. So, you know, you want to them just with kindness. And again, you never know where you'll run into them again. You never know if they somehow go off and buy a 7-Eleven franchise or something, and you're going to deal with them once again in life. So, you know, I really like that piece of it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It was such an important point. I remember when I first started way, way back in the day in human resources as a generalist, and I had a really rough firing with my district HR supervisor, had to come sit in on because it was going to be tough. And we got to the end of it and the person had left, and I looked to them and just said, at what point does it actually get easy to go through these? And she's like, never. And if it ever feels easy, you need to get out of this job, because it should never be easy to do what we just had to do, even if you are completely justified. So I appreciate that he takes the time to put that out there and remind us that this is never going to be comfortable. In fact, he explicitly says it should always feel uncomfortable for everybody, because that is part of it. There's always a human element to this. This is a people business. Everything we do is about people. You never lose sight of the human element is super important. What else when it comes to subtraction and performance management?
I love when he references Jim Collins in his book, Good to Great, to ask yourself about your team or team members, problem ones and good ones. Would you hire them again? I really started thinking about that with my existing team. And thankfully, for the most part, the answer was yes across the board. But it also brought to light maybe a few individuals that I need to start digging into to either, you know, I'm not a big fan of the phrase coach up or coach out, but it really does make sense. Would I hire them again? It's a great question to ask of all of your employees.
I absolutely agree. And I think another question that I would tack onto that now is one that we learned from Jim Cook at Boston Beer. And in his book, and when he's spoken to our groups before, he's always said, does the person you're bringing on raise the team's average? When you go to hire somebody new, are they going to raise the average performance of the team because they're better than the average person on there? And so that's part of that same equation is, would I hire them again? Well, if I hired them again, would they be raising my team's average or keeping it the same or lowering it? And if they're not going to be one of those people that raises the team's average, then I probably wouldn't hire them again. So I do think that's a great way to sort of evaluate your team's existing performance and say, if I had another chance to bring you back, would I? And if I wouldn't, what am I doing to either change that outcome or get somebody new in place? Yep. Very good. What else?
I kind of like the way he just summarized everything by three reasons as to what a person needs to be, to use the term subtracted from, either going down to a leadership failure, personal problems with the employee, or just by plain incompetence. You know, regardless, the overwhelming theme is to treat people with respect, to treat them. I think he put in them, or to treat your team like family, and they will act like family. You know, people have lives outside of their jobs, and you know, you have to always take into account what's going on with the people that, you know, that we may not be aware of, you know. So just having just a common courtesy, common dignity, treating people with common dignity, I think it goes a huge way. You know, it really does, you know.
One of the things that he alludes to, he doesn't say it in the same language that I've always used, but he does talk about sort of the difference between conduct versus performance, that there are certain things that you get an opportunity to improve, like poor performance, and that there are certain things that are just zero tolerance, failure of character, I believe is the phrase that he uses, where there's no three-strike system on being lazy or unethical or otherwise, you know, rude and things like that. That if you curse out a team, there was no, how do I get better at not cursing people out? No, you just stop. You just stop cursing out the customer. You just stop stealing, or you're gone if you do. It's that simple and clean. And I think that's another thing to keep in mind, that there are those two different types of performance issues. There's conduct issues, which comes down to things like, you know, if you don't show up and you don't call while you're at it, the classic no call, no show, that's not a performance problem. That's a behavior problem. That's a conduct problem. You have just failed to meet the most basic of human courtesy and competence. So I'm not going to deal with that the same way that I'm going to deal with someone who's given it everything they got and still struggling to keep up. I like that he breaks that down, because I think that's a big part of how we deal with performances. You got to know what kind of performance you're dealing with. Is this an issue that someone needs to just flip the switch and do better? Or is this something that performance coaching and giving some time and some better skill sets is going to improve? Skill set will never improve someone who is lazy or incompetent, but it can help improve people who are struggling to get the job done because of knowledge, because of experience, or because of organization, things like that. So another interesting point. The last thing I want to get you guys' thoughts on, because I love it so much, is I've used this phrase forever, and I've borrowed this to the point of stealing it. It's the lawnmower that will never go back to my neighbor. Sanctioned incompetence. I love this phrase and this idea of sanctioned incompetence. Anybody remember sanctioned incompetence and what he's talking about and why it matters?
Yeah, I highlighted this one. There was a phrase in here, and it says, don't keep jerks. Life is too short to work with them. And really way too short to pay them and work with them too. And it's interesting because we've had a recent, we'll just call him a jerk, that we had to fire. And I had a conversation with Jay Martin about it. And he has a different phrase about this, and you can reach out to him and ask him. He says it a little differently, but it was the same thing. Just don't, first of all, don't hire them. But, you know, sometimes we don't, they hide in the interview, but certainly don't keep jerks.
Just to touch on what Susie was saying is, I think I know who she's talking about, but even if you're short-staffed, even if you can't be afraid to let that person go, if by keeping that person on is causing more harm to the entire team as well. So yes, it might put you in a bind until you can restaff that position. But the damage that it'll do by keeping someone on can far outweigh that. So I think that's important as well.
And Dustin, you're exactly right. And that's why I like the phrase sanctioned incompetence, because as the leader, when we ignore problems, when we don't address problems, we are sanctioning that incompetence in front of the whole team. And we've all been in that position where we're sitting there going, why does nobody deal with so-and-so, right? Because we're not privy necessarily to how other people are being handled until the, you know, the end result. But if you've ever been on that position of looking around and going, why does nobody deal with such and such a person's performance, that, you know, that jerk's performance, then you know what it's like to your own teams when we don't deal with their, you know, team members' performance. When we allow things to go on too long, when we give people a pass, when we let those prima donnas who are really good but really awful people go on and keep performing without having to be accountable for the rest of it, we're sanctioning that behavior. We're implicitly telling our teams this is an okay way to get business done. And the ripple effect, the poison effect that has on everybody else is terrible. Not just in that it will encourage mimics, right? If we allow it with one, we'll allow it with others. But it also just, it makes the rest of the team bitter towards you as their leader. That they see it. Our teams see what we see. But when we just ignore the problem, are afraid to confront the problem, and sometimes it's not that we don't know it's a problem, it's just that we are too timid to get something done about it, or we're too afraid of being down a person to deal with it now, the net effect on everybody else is they see that and it looks like weak leadership to them. And we don't want to be in that position. So I love sanctioned incompetence, because it implies that when you make the decision to ignore these problems, you are not just being permissive, you're basically endorsing that this is okay. You're telling the world it's okay to perform like this on my team. Nothing's going to happen to you. And that is not a message I think anybody wants to send, but to not send that message, you got to be intentional. Very cool. Final thoughts on business is easy till people get involved. We've talked a lot about it, but it's a lot to talk about because it's people, and people are what we are all about.
I think just turnover is tough. I mean, it's expensive. But I think that even more than the cost of turnover is the morale. And I think especially in what we do, especially for me in sales, is, you know, all my team members are almost their individual business leaders. So they're out amongst themselves. So like you just said, people don't know, you know, the coaching that's going on with this person over here, because so they don't know. So when that person just gets let go, they're starting to wonder, well, what did that guy do? What did she do? What did he do? Like, am I next? You know, and you just never want people walking on eggshells while they're working. So I think just turnover like that, especially when it's not obvious to others, is really tough on the morale.
It can be, make no mistake, but I can almost promise you, Chris, that there's very little time that somebody gets let go and everybody else doesn't look and go, oh yeah, no, I know why that happened. It may be a bit in our business because they don't all work together very closely or all the time. But certainly if your team has any proximity to each other, they always know. It's rarely a surprise when somebody gets let go for our side of the equation. Now, if they leave on their own, obviously that's a whole different thing, but, yep, they're watching. They're watching everything we do. They're looking at everything we do, and how we handle hiring and firing telegraphs to our team a lot about what we want and expect from them as well. So it's a crucial part of being a leader is getting this stuff right. In fact, maybe the most important thing you do as a manager is manage the people and hire and fire the right people and hold them accountable the right way. It'll make or break how easy your life can be. So very cool. Final thoughts, going once, going twice, and sold. All right. Well, I think we've talked this one out, so I will thank my group for being here and we will head on to the next chapter. Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Dan, thanks for being here.
Of course. Thanks.
Chris, glad to have you as always.
Thank you, Jeff.
Dustin, appreciate your insights.
Thank you, Jeff.
And Suzanne, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff.
All right. And we will be back again next week with the next episode of the Entree Leadership Book Club here on season 1 of the Brew University Book Club podcast. Join us then and we'll see you next time.